I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The pandemic has so dominated the news that it's easy to forget that opioids are still a serious public health threat that have done untold hurt and harm to many families across the country. Our guest, Congresswoman Madeleine Dean, knew there was something wrong, something different about her son, Harry Cunan, starting when he was a teenager. His friends were different. His personality had changed. He'd lost weight, lost interest in school, and the brightness in his eyes was gone. Harry was addicted to painkillers and was living a double life, hiding a secret from his parents until they caught him stealing money from them to support his habit. Madeleine Dean and Harry Cunan have co-authored a new book, Under Our Roof: A Son's Battle for Recovery, A Mother's Battle for Her Son. It's an honest and intimate account about what addiction can do to a family, even a family that has many of the advantages in life. Let me introduce our two guests to you. Madeleine Dean is a congresswoman representing the 4th District of Pennsylvania. Madeleine Dean, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is your son, Harry Cunan. He's a recovery advocate, resource director at Karen Treatment Centers. Harry Cunan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Madeleine Dean, let me begin with you. As you write, and I think all parents can relate to this, you worried about all your children, your three boys. But there was something obviously going on with Harry that required a kind of a constant vigilance. When did you notice that there was something different, something changing about your son, Harry Cunan?
It was second year of high school. He bounded into high school with enthusiasm, the biggest heart, a big smile, bright eyes, and something started to slip, maybe second year of high school, third year of high school, and then definitely the last year of high school. The kid that went in joyful, bouncing, had to be dragged across the finish line of graduation. And so we had those years of struggle, me trying to figure out what was going on, him hiding what was going on from us. It was those high school years.
And what did you think was going on with your son, Harry, to explain this changed behavior?
I thought all along, Marty, that it was drugs. So in some ways, I thought I knew what was happening. But you see it through the book, how ignorant I was of the reality of it. I drug tested him. We battled. He would feel the tension in the house rising and would do whatever he could to defeat the drug test that I was going to administer. So I thought it was drugs all along, but I did not understand what addiction really looked like and what toll it was taking on him.
In fact, let me quote what you say. You were both a pair of well-matched idiots. He trying to fool me, me trying to outwit him, failing in the end. You both failed in the end.
We did. I wonder what Harry thinks of that, but that's what it felt like. I felt like we were constantly at each other. I felt like there was a fire inside the house and nobody knew it. It was just me. So that kind of sort of desperation and panic of a mother chasing and trying to figure out what was going on, all at the same time, really, in a version of denial of what addiction was really doing to Harry.
Addiction, such a tricky thing. Harry, let me get you in on the conversation. And you write, well, from the outside, you know, you look like a pretty happy kid. As far back as I can remember, you write, I saw myself as an outsider. I felt uncomfortable in almost every situation. Help us understand what was going on inside of you.
So for me, I mean, it was hard to see at the moment, you know, as I got into recovery and kind of looked back in hindsight, it was a little bit more clear that maybe something wasn't right in the way that I was regulating my emotions, the way that I felt, my perspective and my outlook on who I was and what I was doing. And when it came for me to try substances, the feeling that I got seemed at the moment to really solve all of those problems. It took away the anxiety, the fear, the discomfort that I felt in my day-to-day life. And at the moment, really seemed to be a solution for me.
You even describe, I mean, crying yourself to sleep at night. I mean, and being afraid that if people got to know you, they wouldn't like you. Where do you think that came from?
I don't know where it came from. You know, I'll say I grew up in an amazing household, and I talk about that. My parents were supportive. I'm incredibly fortunate in the home that I was raised and the support and the love that I had around me. But I think, you know, when we look at this as a mental health issue or a disease, not some sort of moral failing, it makes a little bit more sense that there was something going on and I just couldn't pinpoint it.
Yeah. Madeline Dean, you and your son wrote separately, and each chapter has something that you've written and something that your son, Harry Conan, has written. There must have been parts of this book as you read it that were shocking, painful, revelatory.
Very much. What you just mentioned, his fears as a child, I had no idea of that. It was very painful to read that, and then some of the other chapters are extraordinarily painful in terms of when somebody is in such active addiction and the double life they are living. In terms of the process of this book, we purposefully wrote separately. I didn't want to have my memories colored by what his memories were, so we created an outline and then wrote separately and dovetailed the chapters together with the help of our eldest son, who's a great writer, but also, of course, the talented editor. When I read some of his chapters, the one where he is held at gunpoint with a gun to his head, that was, I had no idea until I read it, the truth of that night.
And for you, Harry, were there parts that your mother wrote that were surprising, shocking, concerning to you?
Absolutely. I think the emotional toll that it took on the family, I had a sense that what I was doing was impacting them. I also had a sense earlier on that I might have been better at kind of covering it up than I was. So just to see the years of worry and anxiety and sort of unknowing that I put on them was hard to read, you know, because it's something that I know that this is a family disease. It impacts the entire family. And I knew that I had given her a really hard time. But to actually look at sort of the day-by-day progression of how it got worse for me, it continued to also get worse for not just my mom, but my dad, my brothers, and everyone close to me.
Well, I just have to say, I appreciate the honesty from both of you as you talk about this, but also as you wrote about it as well, because it's not an easy thing to write about. And frankly, there were moments in reading this book where I just, you know, my eyes welled up because of the obvious pain that was going on. Harry, you do describe, you know, trying alcohol as kids do when they're teenagers. It didn't really, wasn't something that you connected with or made you even feel anything or even good. But there was something about marijuana and then, you know, later opioids that gave you something that made you feel better. What was that?
So part for me, I never, you know, it may sound crazy, but I never wanted to feel out of control. You know, when I drank alcohol, I could often black out or, you know, I'd slur my speech. I wouldn't remember, you know, I'd be stumbling. When it came to marijuana, cocaine, opiates, it was something that allowed me to feel more in control. And also felt to be easier to hide because I wasn't slurring my speech. I wasn't stumbling. I wasn't blacked out. So that was something for me that because it became easier to hide in some ways, it became easier to incorporate it into using every single day.
Did using those particular drugs, did that help you be, in a sense, a better liar? Which, of course, you had to in order to support your habit.
I don't know if I'd connect using those drugs with sort of becoming a better liar. You know, I talk about in the book, I was raised, I knew right from wrong. I had a good sense of sort of morals, for lack of a better word, due to you know, not just what my parents and school and everyone around me had taught me, but through good examples, people around me who were living these things. And so I say that to say that I didn't initially plan to sort of start spreading all of these lies. It just starts with one small one.
Yeah.
And with each additional lie and each additional step that I took, it just grows and snowballs to a point where, for me, it was completely out of control and unmanageable.
Madeline Dean, you describe having a neighbor come to your house and say, you know, I think your son Harry is using drugs. What was your response to what they said?
It was our dear friend Sean, our next door neighbor. And I knew it was coming from a place of love from him, but it wounded me. I was battling. I was sure it was drugs, but to have it reflected at me was wounding. And I think I got defensive and tried to shut down the conversation. And I look back on that and I think, how stupid. He was seeing the same thing I was seeing. Why did I care that he said those words? And I think part of it is language. It's very hard to say my son is an addict. Yeah. That word is so harsh. But it wounded me, but it was really out of a place of love, and I thank him for doing that.
Well, indeed. And you also write, when you were teaching at LaSalle and your son Harry was a student there, that while you and he were fighting, you know, privately, publicly, you were one of his greatest defenders.
I was. Turns out I was perhaps defending too much. I thought he always deserved a defense. I always was by his side if he needed me. And so in some ways you can see through the book that I was defending a ghost. I didn't really know what was going on with Harry. Harry is a terrific storyteller. Now he speaks in honesty. But in those days, I thought he was harmed, he was wronged, and he was. But I didn't have the whole story. So I stood by his side.
Harry, we're almost up on a break here, but storyteller, you are and were a good storyteller?
Yes. I mean, that's, you know, came with trying to cover up and hide everything that was going on. I had to constantly create a distraction from the truth because I was in and out of crazy and horrible situations, and to avoid anyone seeing what was really going on, I had to distract them with a story or a lie.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Harry Cunanan, and he is the son of Madeline Dean, who represents Pennsylvania in the U.S. Congress. They have co-authored a new book, Under Our Roof, A Son's Battle for Recovery, A Mother's Battle for Her Son. They also have a book for children, for young children, You Are Always Loved, A Story of Hope. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Pennsylvania Representative Madeline Dean and her son, Harry Cunanan, about their new book, Under Our Roof. It's about Cunanan's battle with addiction and his success with recovery. Also, Dean's battle with and for her son. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Madeline Dean, let me go back to you. And there's a lot of arguments between you and your son in this book. I don't know if that was, if that's sort of your style as a mother to be combative with her children, or if there was something about Harry and certainly this time in his life that just brought the battles to the home front.
I hope that's not a reflection of my mothering. all of the time, but I knew I was in a locked battle with Harry for several years. And PJ, my husband, was not unaware of it. And he would try to literally play in between us to try to calm me down as I was searching for what was going on with Harry and to try to bring Harry to some understanding of the turmoil that it was causing in our house. So I was definitely the bad cop in that set of years. And I have to say, you know, Harry is now 8 years, 3 months and several days into recovery. We don't battle like that anymore. You can heal from this stuff. You don't have to live in that kind of pitch battle. And so now we have a better relationship than I could ever have imagined.
Well, that's so good to hear. Harry, Madeline Dean talked about in reading that you were robbed at gunpoint. There was kind of a home invasion. I have to say, a very frightening experience as you were in the throes of addiction. But you write after that, I felt good that you had street cred or that you would have some kind of campus spotlight because of what had happened to you. Does that tell us something about your addiction?
It does. I mean, my perception of the world was incredibly skewed. And that's, you know, one instance that we wrote about in the book. But the lifestyle that I was living and the places I went and the people I went around, it wasn't that unusual for something like that to happen. So by saying that, what I'm really saying is my outlook on what seemed normal at that time was so far from reality. And it really kind of colored my entire perspective on what I was going through because I had surrounded myself with people who were doing similar things to me in order to try to make it feel more okay, you know, that it's not as taboo, it's not as bad, because everyone that I associated with was doing similar things.
You had several run-ins with the police. What happened? How did they treat you?
I was treated, the way I put it in the book, was unfairly fair. I was given break after break, second chance after second chance, where time and time again, I'd be stopped by the cops and, you know, either they'd search me or oftentimes it wouldn't even get that far and they would let me go. You know, I think I looked at, you know, the color of my skin. I'm a white kid from the suburbs. I'm in the city. You know, and I looked really young on top of that, and just over and over, because of all of those unfair privileges and advantages that I had, every run-in that I had with the police was ended with me being able to walk away and go home.
In fact, Madeline Dean, you write about this. I mean, if Harry had been a, you know, black teenager from North Philadelphia, how do you think the police would have treated him?
Sadly, very differently. We wrote about it because white privilege didn't protect us from the disease of addiction. It doesn't protect anybody. It doesn't care your age, your socioeconomic status, doesn't care the color of your skin, but we know society has a skewed look at those who are addicted. We knew when Harry and I talked about it, that based on where he lived, the car he drove, the fact that he had extra means, and very importantly, the color of his skin, he was treated differently. We visited Karen Fromhold Prison in Philadelphia. And we both knew, almost unspoken at that day, that this was a prison that could have been Harry's, should have been Harry's, if everybody were treated the same. And of course, I really reject the way we have treated those with addiction. And we have to lift up that notion of the discrimination against people of color or people who are poor.
As a member of Congress, what can you do about that?
Well, I hope, literally, I hope that if I can shine a light on our stumbles, our struggles, and then Harry's success, maybe it will begin to stop the stigma, stop the shame, and maybe also our criminal justice system. And I fought at the Pennsylvania House level against a criminal justice system that criminalizes addiction, criminalizes mental illness. We know far too many of those who are in prison in Pennsylvania are in prison because of addiction, because of mental illness. So what I can do is to fight for a fairer criminal justice system. I also have legislation I've introduced around stigma, around fairness in pricing of medication, and around fairness in health insurance, that we should cover this disease fully. It should be mainstream medicine to cover addiction.
Harry, can you talk about stigma from your perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, we talked earlier about kind of all the lies and deception, and all of that was to cover up what was really going on. I think the interesting part of stigma to me is that there's this outside, external stigma from society that using drugs makes you a bad person, or you're, you know, failing morally. But outside of the external pressures, there's an incredible amount of shame and guilt that I felt, because I knew what I was doing was wrong, and it wasn't what I wanted to do, and it wasn't who I wanted to be. But I hadn't seen recovery. I hadn't seen a way out. And something to just pivot for just a moment to acknowledge is, you know, so our book is about what our family went through, you know, and it's about, for me, the opiates. But I just want to highlight, this is, you know, substance use disorder is not just opiates. You know, we need to look at all substances, stimulants, alcohol, whatever it may be. And also look at the fact that there's many different pathways to recovery. Recovery can look different for a lot of people. So going back to the stigma part of it, in this book, we really tried to highlight the recovery side, and not spend the entire book talking about active addiction and then have recovery be almost a footnote at the end. So we split the book in half in order to talk about what recovery looks like in early recovery and rebuilding and getting close to where we are today. Because I think there's hope in that. And when you can see and point at the positives of recovery, I believe that that's something that can help to show people who are feeling that shame, that stigma, that there is another option. There's potentially a way out and there's hope.
Well, I do want to talk about how you got into recovery. Let me turn back to you, Madeline Dean. Harry was, as it turns out, stealing money from you and your husband. I guess your husband's leaving his wallet on the kitchen counter or something, as parents do. But credit cards were missing. I guess cash was missing. And I wonder from your perspective and looking back, whether that was kind of a call for help from your son, Harry, because, you know, at some point that was going to catch up to him or to you.
That's exactly right. I have had that mental conflict, wondering, was that his call for help? What happened was, it was sort of a crazy time in our house. I was up for election. I'm the person who generally pays the bills. I wasn't paying close attention to our account for 2 to 3 weeks before the election in November of 2012, where I was being elected for the first time, reelected to the Pennsylvania House. My husband, PJ, said, "Mad, would you pay the American Express bill?" And so I went to the ATM and noticed a balance that was just ridiculously too low. And so I went into the bank and I asked the banker, "Can you take a look? There's something wrong with this account. I should be able to have about $4,000 in there." And she took a look and she said, "Are you in the habit of using your ATM a lot?" Wow. So we examined, and it was clear to me, shocking and clear to me, that night after night after night, Harry was going down using PJ's ATM and getting money to support the habit. I said, "Please print out the statements." And I called my husband. I said, "That's it. It's drugs. I know it."
Harry, do you think, again, in hindsight, do you think that was a call for help on your part to get caught that way?
I don't know, but I don't think so. You know, maybe on some level, But really, at the time, it was an act of desperation, a hopelessness, the sense of, you know, I started the first time I did that. And again, it was like, I knew it was wrong. But the pain of withdrawal is incredibly intense and incredibly motivating to in the wrong direction often. So I had tried to rationalize and justify that I was going to pay it back, you know, when I got my next paycheck. And it just quickly spiraled. It didn't take long for it to get exposed. You know, it was within just a couple of weeks before everybody kind of found out. But I don't think it was an intentional cry for help or trying to get myself caught. There would have been easier ways, I think, to do that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Harry Cunnan. He's a recovery advocate, resource director at the Karen Treatment Centers. He's been an active member of the addiction recovery community since his recovery began. That was more than 8 years ago. Co-author with his mother, Under Our Roof, A Son's Battle for Recovery, A Mother's Battle for Her Son. His mother happens to be Congresswoman Madeleine Dean, and she has represented the 4th Congressional District of Pennsylvania in the U.S. Congress since 2018. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if you can connect with the conversation that we are having. So, Harry, you did go into recovery, and this was as a result of a kind of a sit-down, one of those interventions with your parents. How reluctant were you to go into recovery? I'll put it that way.
So by the time I was confronted, then this wasn't, you know, you talked about we had been battling for years and I had always come up with an excuse in the past. But for me personally, at this point in time, when I was confronted with the truth, I knew I had been caught stealing. I was so broken and hopeless and desperate that I didn't have the energy to try to spin another story or come up with some out there excuse or justification for what had happened. And I was so desperate that I was willing to try anything else because I knew everything I had tried to stop this on my own had failed. And I was out of ideas on ways to turn my life around. So I was at that moment open and willing to try something new.
Is that when people talk about hitting bottom? Do you think that's where you were at that point?
I think it's, you know, I don't love the idea and the sort of concept of hitting bottom. I think in hindsight, it could be easy for me to say, yes, that was my bottom. But I also know without any doubt that had I said no, there's ample opportunity for a lower bottom. And sadly, you know, a lot of people's bottom because this disease can be fatal is death, you know, or is winding up in jail or prison for a long time. So I don't love the idea of hitting bottom because I think you hear that mostly from people who are in recovery and felt like that was a bottom that they could sort of use as an opportunity to try something different. But it's a dangerous notion because it can always go lower to the point where, you know, someone sadly dies as a direct result of this.
I appreciate that clarification. Very important. Madeleine Dean, can you read the letter that you wrote to Harry? I guess when you dropped him off at the Karen Center, this was October 30th, 2012, and it is included in the book.
Yes, and you might imagine we confronted him that day and he said yes, and so we scurried about the house, getting him whatever he needed to go. I was determined that we go immediately that day, and it took us a couple of hours. And it occurred to me as we were running to the car, jumping in the car, I won't be able to talk to Harry for a while. So I grabbed some bland note card and scribbled something in the car, and this is what I wrote. 5:15 p.m. My dear Harry, it seems so strange to be driving to Karen on the heels of the terrible storm Sandy, but the day seems bright to me. This should be a very good day for you. This is a very good day for you. You have asked for help, the help you need to be healthy, happy, well. I love you. I'm proud of you. As worried as Daddy and I have been, I have such optimism and confidence in you. You are an amazing young man of many gifts. You are smart, handsome, kind, loving, funny. Addiction has tried to bury your gifts. Don't let that happen. Reclaim them all for yourself. That will be the greatest thing you could ever do for your adoring Aubrey. I love you more than you know. Daddy too. Mommy, remember to pray often to God, to Walter, to my parents. Nothing is impossible with the Lord. XXOO, written in the car. Sorry, so sloppy.
And Harry, you write, I took another drag of my cigarette and stared at the card, searching for the optimism my broken mother had expressed. I didn't feel it. I wasn't ready. I was still mourning the loss of my life, the only life I had known. Can you speak about that letter today? It's a beautiful letter.
To me, it's still to this day amazes me that, you know, the one she said, I'm proud of you. And I could not comprehend that at the time because of the shame that I felt, because of the sadness and just brokenness that I had been living for so long. I couldn't see the pride. I couldn't see the optimism. And I couldn't see how important that day might have been for me when I was living it. In hindsight, that was one of the most impactful days of my life.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to do that. We're only we're up in a break. And Harry, hold on to that thought. That's Harry Canaan, and he is the son of Madeleine Dean, Congresswoman Madeleine Dean from Pennsylvania. And we've been talking about their new book, Under Our Roof, A Son's Battle for Recovery, A Mother's Battle for Her Son. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after we be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Congresswoman Madeleine Dean and her son, Harry Canaan, about addiction and recovery and their new book, Under Our Roof. Harry, you were talking about the letter, and I had to jump in and interrupt you. Can you finish your thought there?
No, that's okay. I've sort of lost my train of thought
okay,
at the moment.
That happens to me. Yeah, yes. That happens to me as well. Let me read an email from Wendy, and I'll give you both a chance to respond. Wendy says, thanks for your brutal honesty in sharing this painful journey with your much-loved son. There is so much shame around addiction. This prevents people from being honest with themselves and their loved ones. Thank you for dropping that veil of shame. It's so important in the road to recovery, sending love and healing your way. Madeleine Dean, can you respond to that?
I thank Wendy for that. That's what we thought. If we can say that this was going on under our roof in what I think is a pretty ordinary family, certainly a family of a lot of love and a lot of gifts, but we thought if we can do this, maybe somebody else will see themselves in us and our struggles, and most importantly, in recovery. So, Wendy, I thank you for recognizing that. And that's what we want, to drop the shame, to drop that curtain of shame.
I wonder too, Madeleine Dean, whether, and I mentioned this in my introduction, whether the pandemic, which has just, you know, dominated our conversations, whether that has really overshadowed the threat that opioid addictions still pose to so many families, so many people in this country.
Well, that's the way I've been talking about it pre-pandemic and now during the pandemic. This is an epidemic in our country. There's a study that shows from May of 19 until May of 20, 81,000 people died of overdose, of addiction.
Wow.
81,000. That is on average 222 people a day. I call it a jetliner, a day of souls being taken from this country, being taken from communities, rocking families. We have to figure out something to ground that jetliner a day. and to stop it. So it is its own epidemic, and now, and Harry can speak to this better than I, made worse by the pandemic. Those numbers are up tragically high as a result of isolation and the pandemic.
Harry, you want to speak to that?
Absolutely. I mean, from what everything I'm seeing, the things that are in place to protect people from the coronavirus really make a lot of aspects of recovery more challenging. So much of recovery for me and for many others has been in community and finding people to help rally around you and support you and get you through. And so much of that has gone virtual, and the connection is harder to find. And as people, you know, are supposed to be socially distancing, it can feel more like isolation, which maybe isn't the intent, but how it can feel, and it just exacerbates so many of these issues. We had been in the media talking about the opioid epidemic for a little while pre this current pandemic, and it was getting a lot of exposure, and I think that in many ways it's a very, very positive thing, and we need to remind everyone that it's not just opioids, it's, you know, substance use disorders in general, with alcohol, opioids, stimulants, anti-anxiety medication. There's so many different facets to this, and all of those areas, you know, you saw alcohol sales were through the roof in this pandemic. And so I think it's important to, you know, our story highlights this one sort of small area of this, but this is impacting people in so many different ways through the use of so many different substances, or, you know, outside of substance use disorder, the mental health concerns that are happening right now are really, really alarming. And we need to do, you know, more to highlight those and to shine a light on it. So I, again, just appreciate you giving us the time today to to share our experience and let others know that you're not alone in this. It's sadly too common right now across this country and I think across the world.
Harry, let me pick up, and you both mentioned that recovery is an important part of this book. You spend a lot of time on it. And again, I think writing very honestly about what recovery entails. And it seems you were very adept at living a double, triple, quadruple life. And it was a matter, at least as I was reading about your recovery, of putting all yourselves back together and being, I guess, what, honest about who you are. And I wonder if you could just help us understand at its base, at its heart, what recovery entails.
So for me, a big part of it was, like you said, figuring out who I was, being authentic, and allowing others in to see that. I think a misconception sometimes is recovery is just a matter of kind of putting the drugs down or putting the drink down.
Right.
And it's so much more than that, because through the years that I was living through an active addiction, I had developed so many maladaptive coping skills, both to just get by, to survive, to cover up what I was doing, that those things don't just disappear when I stop using. You have to work to really try to redevelop and add in new coping skills and new principles of, you know, who do I want to be and how do I want to live my life in a way that I'm okay with, you know, yeah. that I can be happy with, because at the end of the day, that's what's most important. But it's a practice. It takes time and effort and consistent work to just try to improve a little bit day after day.
Madeline, Dean, you described, and I guess this was early on in your son's recovery, going to the treatment center and the patients, I guess, there were, I guess that's the appropriate word, were making presentations. And you write that Harry's presentation, there was something that seemed kind of overly polished or not quite real enough. And I wonder, as a mom, what you were sensing about where he was.
Well, I guess it was the years of his covering up and fanciful stories that were so creatively told to distract from what was going on. And so we were told when he went in for the first 28 days or so of treatment that at the end of that, that the family participates. And so our my other two sons and PJ and I went up and were a part of a weekend. And then that final week when he was going to leave there, there were presentations by the different young men in his unit that would really tell their truth, tell their story. So I actually sort of steeled myself to see, oh, God, am I going to be able to handle whatever he's going to tell us? And yet, while he told a timeline and he told his story, it did seem a little sanitized, that maybe it wasn't all there. I guess, really, it took the writing of this book for me to see the real depths and the hollowing out of who he was as a result of addiction. So in reading his part of the book, I got that true story that I didn't feel like we were getting that day.
Harry, one of the people, maybe one of the counselors described to you that addicts are, quote, egomaniacs with low self-esteem. Can you expand on that? And then we've got some folks that want to join us.
Yes, I don't remember who sort of said that. But I just remember when I was in active addiction, I was so consumed with myself because I had to be in order to maintain the lies and the deception. So that's where sort of that, the egomaniac part, it was all about just, I was incredibly selfish because using drugs became my top priority above all others. But the low self-esteem, I had been so beaten down and so broken based on how I felt that I was just devastated, you know, personally, because I didn't like the way that I was living, but I couldn't see a way out.
When did you know? I mean, is there a moment in recovery when you say, I think I'm on the road to recovery. I think I am getting better.
There was a moment for me when, you know, I realized after a couple of months that I hadn't thought about using drugs and I hadn't really had the desire to use drugs in quite a few days. And that was a real turning point for me. But at the same time, I have to, you know, always reiterate now and to myself that, you know, you don't fully beat this thing. You don't just get to that point and then you're sort of set for life. It's a constant practice because I could very easily, you know, sadly I've seen many others fall back into it. You know, all it takes is to use one time to kind of fall right back into where I was. So I need to be aware of that and vigilant of that so that I can continue to move forward through this process.
Let me read a comment from Barbara, then we'll take Carol in on the conversation. Barbara says, I went through the same thing with my daughter years ago. She made it out and is now a successful yoga teacher. Thank you for sharing this story. Let me get Carol on line one to join our conversation. And Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I also am a parent of a child in recovery. She is now 32, and after five rehabs and many tries, she has been clean now for 5 years. And
wow.
I thank you for your book. I also, you know, I felt your letter so much because when she told me she needed help, I said, this is the best day. And she was like, Mom, that's awful to say. And I'm like, it is. It was the beginning, and it took a long time. But I also am so proud of her. She just got married, buying a house, and just told me last week she's pregnant with my first grandchild.
Oh, my goodness.
Congratulations.
And she has, you know, has continued to go to meetings and is very active in her recovery, but will always give credit to that her recovery for where she is. I also wanted you to speak, Madeline, maybe to the parents' recovery. I did go to a Karen parent support group for years while she was going through this. Every Tuesday night with other parents of addicted children. And I think that was a saving grace for me because I had to learn how to recover from being an enabler and a codependent. And I also have to constantly practice that because I can fall back in with, especially with my other two children who I worry about, trying to control them, and I have to say, let go, let God. So that's all. Thank you.
Well, no, that's a terrific call. I really appreciate you calling in. Madeline Dean, I'm sure you want to say something back to Carol.
Absolutely. And to Barbara before. Barbara, congratulations and God bless. Carol, you and your daughter, please say hello to her from us. She's another one of these stories of hope and healing. You said things that were entirely parallel to me. When I was trying to figure out what was going on, I went to a couple of those Karen parent meetings over in, I think the one I went to was in Plymouth Meeting. And I was at that point trying to discover what was going on. Was I onto this? Was Harry really addicted? And those meetings were helpful. It was another Karen parent alum who literally helped me see right through what was going on. And honestly, over a cup of coffee, say everything you're describing is the telltale signs of Harry deep in addiction. So you're absolutely right. Parent support, spouse support is really critically important. We went to Karen, our family support. We went to Karen and the family came for the weekend. And I worried when Harry went into recovery, would the brothers support him? Well, they surrounded him with love. And so it's really important for families to learn through this process and understand addiction as the disease that it is, and also what our role in it is.
Harry, do you know now that when your mother was fighting with you, she was fighting for you?
I do. And I think I always knew that. And, you know, again, just to echo congratulations, it's amazing always to hear the positive stories, because I think so often we hear the negative ones, which are important because we need to realize what this disease can look like in all aspects. But I think I always knew my mom was fighting for me, had my best interests at heart. But it came back to the shame and the stigma of how I felt about what I was doing, and that if I exposed that, then maybe she might not be ready to fight for that.
Hmm. You have two children, Harry?
I do. I've got a 9-year-old Aubrey, a 1-year-old Sawyer, my wife Juliet, and I have one a little girl on the way in June.
Oh my goodness. So your grandmom several times over, Madeline Dean.
Oh, I'm so lucky. And we also have Ella, my other granddaughter, who is Pat's and Stephanie's daughter. So we have three and a fourth on the way. And that's what's so amazing. Where we were in the depths of Harry's addiction, I couldn't fully picture the healthy, beautiful life he has. And I'm sure he was trying to figure out how to picture that. But we want others to know there is health and healing and the joy of a beautiful wife and family. It's available for others, I hope, too.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Madeline Dean, Harry Conan, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been our privilege.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Madeline Dean, Congresswoman. She represents the 4th Congressional District of Pennsylvania. Harry Conan is a recovery advocate, resource director at Karen Treatment Centers. They have co-authored two books, one we've been talking about today on Radio Times, Under Our Roof, A Son's Battle for Recovery, A Mother's Battle for Her Son, and one for little kids, You Are Always Loved, A Story of Hope. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.